Hi, listeners. Thank you for tuning in to Disrupt, a home healthcare news podcast. I'm Morgan Gonzalez, the associate editor of HHCN, and I'll be your host for this episode. We want to let you know that if you subscribe to the podcast directly through SoundCloud, a change that we've recently made in our infrastructure could affect your subscription. We apologize for the inconvenience and encourage you to subscribe through a podcast player such as Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Now, on to our show. Today, I'm chatting with Mike Johnson, Chief Researcher of Home Care Innovation at Bayada. Mike sat down with me to discuss the cutting-edge innovations set to transform the industry, including remote patient monitoring and risk prediction models. We also chatted about how fluctuating regulations will transform the industry and the reimbursement revolution happening in home-based care. Let's dive right in. Hi, Mike. Thanks so much for joining me on Disrupt today.
Great. Thanks for the invitation. I'm looking forward to the conversation, Morgan.
Awesome. Okay. I want to start with the elephant in the room because I think it's really hard to ignore in home-based care right now. In talking previously, you have said that the proposed home health Medicare rate cut, which amounts to a 9% cut, practically speaking, would reduce providers' ability to invest in innovation. Mm-hmm. What else could go by the wayside if this rule goes through as is?
So, and I'll just repeat sort of what I said and you mentioned, because I think it is worth it. Let's just be clear. This is a 9% cut to the base rate, which, you know, despite what MedPAC says, our margins, when you take into effect commercial insurance and Medicare Advantage insurance, are not the double-digit margins that they talk about. So for many providers, what this is going to, it's not only going to stifle their innovation, it's going to put them out of business. For providers who are maybe a little bit larger, a little bit more financially savvy, will have some margin left over, but it's going to do a couple of things. One, our innovation fund, as I've talked about, right, home-based services got no money from the High Tech Act. We had to fund our own EHR. As I've said many times, we're fine with that, but you have to look at our surplus as innovation. It's also going to limit the number of people we can take care of, just quite frankly, because we are not going to choose to cut the payment for our nurses and therapists. It would be crazy, but we may not be in a position to give them the annual raises that we might like and other things. And so I do worry about the impact on our workforce, which then will have a direct impact on the number of people we can see. I don't think this is fear-mongering. This is not the end of the world, but it certainly isn't what we would expect for a service that we believe delivers value to patients, clients, and the broader system.
How can providers continue to innovate and evolve services when you're staring down the barrel of something like this? Is there an option to continue doing so?
I think for me, it probably always comes back to strength in numbers. So I think working together, both to advocate, to help lawmakers and regulators and payers understand what we do, is one. Maybe this is a little self-serving as a researcher. Sharing your data, right? Because one of the things we've been doing here at Bayada and the industry is working on is how do we build an evidence base that gets policymakers can pay attention to. And one of the biggest problems that we have is that we don't have a unified data set for home health. And I'll give you a clear example of where that's been a problem is we had an article published about a year and a half ago in JAMA looking at the differences between folks with traditional Medicare and Medicare Advantage. Many of your listeners are familiar with that study. And it demonstrated pretty clearly that there were differences, less therapy, less nursing, shorter visits, and so forth. That article was one of 10 that got cited in the latest MedPAC report, which is actually kind of cool. But the articles they had in there were cited because they basically said they're not generalizable enough. And what they mean by that is this is Bayada data. So it may be true in our world, but it may not be. If we had data from half the industry, we did that same study, that would be much more powerful. And so I would ask folks to give some thought to that, because that's where we can really begin to make a difference in terms of understanding how to deliver better care and then how to get paid either more for it and or differently for it.
But that's exciting that sort of collaboration is possible and could make such a difference.
Yeah. And as I've talked to folks at conferences, there's a general willingness to do that. Now, you have to look at privacy and there's data issues. All those things we can overcome. The first thing you got to start with is, do we have a unifying place to put the data? And do we have folks who are interested and pulling that data. I can assure you there are researchers who would love to have access to that data set. We just need to create it.
Okay, great. And the final rule is likely to be handed down on Halloween, which I think is just too apt in terms of a kind of scary rate reduction on the table. Yes. What's your prediction for what we'll see then?
Oh boy, this is a tough one. And I'm going to give a shout out to a friend and former colleague of mine, Tony DeLonzo, who's now with Humana doing great stuff. And he would be the person to read the final rule. And basically he would say every year it ruins his Halloween. So this is not unusual, but sort of kind of apropos for the times. Given that there was a groundswell of support in terms of the letters that went into CMS to argue against some of the changes. We had record numbers of response letters, so it was good. And that then resulted in a piece of legislation that might have the ability to get passed that would basically put this on hold for 2 years. So I'm generally an optimistic guy. And in cases like this, a month ago, I would have said, I don't think we stand a chance of, I would have said, I think the whole thing's going to go through. I'm feeling a little bit more optimistic that maybe there's a compromise and we get half of that cut. But I would say to folks listening, prepare for 9%.
Well, on that note, let's turn to something. I feel like we needed to get that out of the way. Now let's turn to something that I think might be a little more fun to talk about. I want to ask you what research you're working on, Abiata, that's the most exciting right now. I think your answer might include the recent news of a $310,000 grant from the National Institutes of Health. So congrats on that.
Thank you.
But what's exciting you the most right now?
I'll try to keep it succinct because we got a bunch of stuff going on that is so much fun. And as you know, from a background perspective, I've been at Beata for 17 years. I led the home health practice for 10 years. So, you know, deep operations, which I really enjoyed. This is so different than operations. It's a different part of your brain. And I feel like I'm a little bit ahead of the sled to try to clear the path. And we're having some good success. So one example is with a really great partnership with two researchers at the University of Washington, Rachel Brzezinski and Tracy Meraz. We've done some research around payers and how you get paid makes a difference, the JAMA article I mentioned, which was really cool. We have a second portion of that study coming out in a month in the American Journal of Managed Care that looked at, was there a difference in visit utilization and outcomes if you had traditional Medicare, if you had Medicare Advantage that was paid episodically, or if you had Medicare Advantage that was paid fee-for-service? And actually, no surprise to us, if you're paid Medicare Advantage fee-for-service, the outcomes aren't as good. And so why is that exciting? It gives us an opportunity to have a conversation with the payers that is more than just pay us more. Yes, we think we deserve more, but at a minimum, pay us what you've been paying us, but pay it to us in an episodic framework. Get rid of some of the regulatory oversight face-to-face and so forth, and we'll get you the results that you want at lower cost and so forth. So that for me has been exciting. The NIH grant is actually particularly exciting. And the reason for that is because what we're going to start to look at is what's the magic of how we deliver care, right? So we can predict with our algorithms historically how many nursing, PT, OT, speech visits this one particular person would need. But we don't understand what the magic is about that. So in this study, we're going to look at number of visits, the length of the visit, including front loading, the discipline mix. So maybe the person received 12 visits, 30% nursing, 30% PT, 30% OT, and somebody else same had a different mix. And was there a difference in the outcome? So what I've been talking about for a long time that there's not any research at and that we'll start to get it is, what's the right dosage, right? I'm a physical therapist. What's the right dosage of Mike or a physical therapist in this particular case? And is it better to have a higher dosage of nursing and a lower dosage of therapy the other way around? And the answer is it very well, maybe we just don't know. And so that NIH grant, it's a five-year grant in collaboration with the University of Washington that's going to help us start to get at some of that. And there's nothing that I'm familiar with in the literature that starts to look at that. That gets really interesting because now we can start to impact care, you know, writ large. And so those are the two right now that to me have been the most fun. But there's plenty of other stuff to talk about if we have time.
Let's try to come back to this. I think that's fascinating. And you were talking about collecting this data so you can bring it to payers. From where you sit, do payers seem receptive to this type of data to
to considering different payments and reimbursement rates?
Generally, I would say the yes, because it's a really good question. I mean, when I was a clinician, as far as I was concerned, you know, payers were sort of, you know, were the devil, or they felt that way. And they're not, right? Because I've gotten to know people who were in payer organizations. They're doing the same thing we're doing. They're trying to take care of their members. Are there some bad actors that make bad decisions and make payers look bad? Sure. But we have that in home health, unfortunately, as well. But what tends to be the limitation are two things. One, their ability to give us enough attention, because remember, they're paying for hospital stays and things that are much bigger chunks of money. And so in some cases, we're a rounding error. So is that important enough for them to give the time and the energy to come up and not only conceive a new payment model, but then implement it? Because that's the second piece, is their systems oftentimes are built to pay fee for service, and to pay episodic sounds simple, but it's not. It's actually much more complicated. And so those are the things that we run into. But if we can make enough of an argument that moving from a fee for service to a episodic payment could reduce readmissions and so forth, and you can tie a dollar amount to that, it gets their attention enough that at least the ones that are trying to think ahead and trying to be proactive will work very hard to try to figure out how we can make that happen, and then check the data over time and so forth. So I call them enlightened providers, and there are actually quite a few out there that I think are enlightened and trying to do the right thing. Those are the ones we should focus on, because once we have success there, then we can go to the ones who are just maybe not as enlightened or just so buried in other stuff. They'll be grateful for a new solution that could work.
And this gets into something else that I wanted to talk about, which are like the actionable steps that providers can take to move the industry, you know, farther away from a fee-for-service reality. It sounds like collecting this data is an important first step. What else do you think should be happening right now?
I think if we're talking about industry-wide, certainly sharing the data so we have a unified data set. The skilled nursing industry has such a data set, and it does two things for them. One, it becomes a pool for researchers, right, independent of the industry, to really look at this and give good insight into what works and what doesn't work. But the other thing it does is it allows organizations to do benchmarking. Right. So it helps you get a sense of where am I right now? So I use that as a lead into, I think one of the things that we can do as an industry is, as individual providers that are listening to this, make sure you have your house in order. Right. Changing to an episodic payment system isn't going to help you get the outcomes we want to get if you don't have good systems in place to schedule efficiently, to get out to the home early, communication amongst your therapists, your nurses, and so forth. Because Medicare certified home health, especially, but I think healthcare more largely, it's a team sport. And so we spent a lot of time building infrastructure, if you will, to make sure that we had a system to do a screening up front, above and beyond the OASIS. We're working with Medalogix, a company, to look at risk prediction. So those things will all help you get the patients better right now with no change in payment methodology. So do those things first, so you're really ready to reap the benefits of a payment methodology change that we believe would help.
And is episodic that kind of first stepping stone or most realistic stepping stone on the way to some of the more like truly value-based payment models?
Yeah, that's actually a really good question, because there, and even, you know, as I started getting involved with this years ago, it can be really confusing, right? Is an episodic payment, because an episodic payment, to some degree, you could argue, is a value-based payment. Meaning that the value in that case is, if you can get people better for fewer visits and still get the same outcomes, actually your gross margin and your operating surplus is higher, right? So that's the payout. Now, it can't be done at the expense of getting the outcomes, right? That's the tension. So in many respects, Medicare has been paying in a quote unquote value-based. Some people might argue with me, but I think that's fair enough. What we really start thinking about with value-based is, are you getting paid more, upside, bonus, or are you getting paid less, a penalty, depending on your outcomes? And we're there with home health care as well. As folks know, a home health value-based purchasing is basically saying, put your money where your mouth is. And so I think as we've been working on building episodic contracts because we can get better outcomes, it has actually helped prepare us for the next level of value-based purchasing, which is HHVBP. So in some ways, they are kind of a stepping stone. The question that I wonder is, what's beyond home health value-based purchasing? Now, a model that we could look at is what's in hospice. Because in hospice, you get paid a per patient per day payment. And that payment should cover over that period of time all the things you think you need to do to help that patient and family get ready for death and to do it with dignity. Now, obviously, in home health Medicare certified, we're going the other direction. We're trying to get them back to function, but more of a capitated model where you're able to do the things you think you need to do to get the outcomes you want. That gets much more interesting, but certainly harder to budget. That could be a place where we could go. The last thing I'll say about that is, if we were to do that, one of the things that opens up is to do things that are not just clinical or medical. Maybe if we decide that, and I've used this example, maybe even on other podcasts, I did when I did home health, I worked in West Philadelphia for a portion of my West Philadelphia and Upper Darby, Delaware County, if people know Philadelphia. In the summertime, I'd go into those houses and it was 110 degrees. They didn't have air conditioners. This is a person with COPD. They don't need me. They need an air conditioner, but there's no way to pay for that. Right. So it would allow us to start thinking about how do we look at the patient and the person holistically, including their home environment. That's a different muscle than any of us has. But from a future view, that's part of what we can start looking at.
So taking those social determinants of health into consideration.
Said. Yeah, because we know those things have an impact. They just don't have an ICD-10 code, so we can't bill for them. And I can talk about some examples where we've done some of that. But yes, exactly. It would let us look at folks holistically, which is exactly what the hospice benefit does. Spiritual, social, behavioral, psychosocial, medical, all of those things. And that to me is really healthcare delivery.
Is that's the ultimate vision?
At least Mike Johnson's ultimate vision.
And I think you may have mentioned, I think you did mention risk prediction models just now, but when you and I spoke last, we spoke a little bit more about remote patient monitoring and risk prediction models as some of the things that you thought are the most exciting innovations in home health. So I'd love to know, is that still the same or is there something else you'd like to mention? And then how is technology like that going to change the industry?
Yeah, so I'll build on what I said the last time and I'll add to assistance with documentation like ambient listening. Because I think that has such potential, but I'll back up. So telehealth or remote patient monitoring still has great utility. If things don't change, the rules for billing for telehealth will run out either today or tomorrow. So I know people will be listening to this afterwards, but we need to make sure we're advocating because you can do a lot of good for folks, even via video. And then basically you expand your workforce because you've taken driving out of it. So I'm still really excited about that. In terms of risk prediction and algorithms, that continues to be, particularly with artificial intelligence, I think the place where we can really get some insights. And so since we chatted in a previous webcast, we have an embedded scholar at Bayada now who just started last week from Brown University, who's dedicated to a project that we're looking at to assess fall risk in our private duty self-pay business. Right. So Medicare is not telling us we have to do it. Medicaid is not telling the payer, the insurance is. But these are people who are paying out of their pocket for our services, and we are making sure we can do a good risk prediction. So we want to earn their trust, right? We want to differentiate ourselves and demonstrate that we're worth it. And so, in working with that scholar, we're going to have an opportunity to really increase the specificity and accuracy of that model, which is great. But if you do a risk prediction, you got to do something about it, right? So getting the risk prediction is just the beginning. Then we start to look at what interventions based on the things that set off the risk prediction model would be the right things to do. The reason we're looking at the risk prediction to reduce falls is because we believe the downstream impact is hospitalization or more costs. So making some nice progress on that. And eventually, to me, that can apply to all of our practices, that kind of a model. And when you talk to Medicaid payers, the states are under a ton of stress. If we can show them a way that we can be proactive and reduce readmissions or admissions, not just readmissions, that's a conversation that they're interested in. And then the final piece is this, how do we reduce the documentation time for clinicians? It's personal for me because I am a clinician. I did home health. I didn't go to PT school to be a scribe. And EHRs, the promise of EHRs is they were going to improve quality. That's still debatable, but I do think the potential is there. And in some ways they have, but it was going to make the lives of clinicians easier. It has made our lives harder. There's more to document. It's harder to interact with the patient. And if technology can intervene there or intercede. So I can say something and it gets transcribed right onto the OASIS. That's a game changer. And we're seeing examples. That's it. That is coming within the next year. And so for me, that person as a clinician, that is super exciting. I might go back and start treating patients again occasionally if I didn't have to do all the paperwork. So that would be my one add.
Do you think there will be patient pushback on some of this? I mean, that was something when I covered behavioral health and we were talking about notes for therapists. One of the questions that always came up was, are the patients going to be okay with this? So on the, you know, home-based care side, are patients going to be okay with this?
Yeah, great question. I think they will be as long as we're upfront and transparent. What's interesting is the population of folks who are older today, the ones that I took care of 30 years ago when I was a PT, you just did what the doctor told you. And because I was a male, I was the doctor. I'm not a doctor. Well, I am, but it's a PhD. It's a different doctor. the female clinicians were always nurses and we were always doctors. But the point of the matter is, do what the nurse says or do what the doctor says. That's less the case now. Right? More and more people want to be like, okay, you said to do this. Tell me why. And so I think that is probably the best thing that could happen in healthcare is we get challenged. And so being upfront about what we're doing and why, whether it be an exam maneuver or a test that I'm doing, or why I'm going to use this ambient listening technology to actually improve the quality of the care. And I think it will be an easy sell if it goes something like this. We've got this device that's going to record the visit. It's going to take everything you say and everything I say and put it in. So I'll remember all of it. That recording will get erased. And what it's going to do is let me pay attention to you today. So the whole conversation we have is I am here and present, and I'm not turning my head every 5 seconds. I think patients are already pushing back on some of the technology because it feels like the person's not paying attention to them. I think that we can do immediately. And we know psychologically, if you feel like the person that takes care of you cares about you, you actually got a leg up. This is going to let us do that in ways we haven't been able to do for a while.
Well, let me tell you, your PhD in my book is definitely a doctor. I thought I was going to try to get a PhD one day, and then I got my master's, and I said, nope, I'm done with that. So all of the respect in the world for you.
You were smarter than me. I couldn't stop myself.
this technology that we're talking about, I mean, you're saying this ambient listening is happening. Is what of this is going to become table stakes, do you think? What is everyone going to have to get on?
Oh, I think the documentation is absolutely going to be table stakes. Every major EMR, you know, whether it be WellSky or Axis or Homecare Homebase, they've got teams dedicated to this. You look at the amount of money that's going into artificial intelligence, but from a healthcare perspective, the first thing I'm seeing, now there are probably some other things that are going on, but for me as a clinician, table stakes is you're going to have some way to have that clinician have the conversation captured, have it implemented into the OASIS. So all I have to do and should do, right? We should absolutely not trust AI without doing a double check, is go through that, miss this, miss that, but and then clean it up. Because I think right now a start of care takes 2.5 hours. I think there is every reason to believe it could take half of that. And then, you know, to me, that's a game changer. My worry is if we move slow at Beata, people who work here, who love us, are going to go to the place that's is the hour and 15 minutes instead of 2.5 hours. And so I think the pressure of all of us is going to be to race to the bottom in this way, a good way, the minimum amount of documentation that has to happen to get good outcomes and deliver good care.
And I assume that something like AI scribing, whatever the official word is, will help with workforce struggles as well. What do you have your eye on as something that can make the most difference there?
So there's a couple of things. So first, you know, if for example, if you made the decision, if AI could help cut down a start of care visit from, I'm going to go out on the limb and say from 2.5 hours to 1 hour and 15. I don't think we're going to be able to cut it by 50%, but I think even if it's 30%, but let's just use that as an argument. One of the things you could do is you could, because we pay our clinicians based on the amount of work that they have to do. If the work is half, you could make an argument as a provider. I'm not recommending this specifically, but to be clear, you could have that clinician do 2 starts of care when they were only able to do 1. I don't think you want to go quite there, but I do think they could probably see another patient or two in the week. Why do I say that? All of a sudden, your workforce capacity goes up without hiring an additional single person. So optimizing the existing, and I believe if the clinician's doing half of the documentation, I would be glad to see a couple more patients because it won't take me more time. And I'll be doing the things I like to do, which is actually spending time with that person. So I think that portion should help with the workforce. And then there are, with AI, there's lots of other things they're doing to be able to identify in this recruiting process who's a good fit for the industry, right? So I think there's places on the front end where we can help identify the right people and save a lot of people a lot of time and energy who maybe isn't in the right setting. So those would be the two places that I would think of. But I'm sure that there are other places that this from a workforce perspective should be really helpful.
And you were saying that there can be some increased efficiency with the right digital tools. Is increased efficiency enough for providers to make it through some of the rate cuts that and other pressures that we're seeing? I know you've mentioned that some providers will have to close, but is increased efficiency enough to prevent some of that?
It could be and probably will be depending on the size of this cut. And maybe we can all weather this cut, but at some point, even that efficiency is going to get eaten away if the cuts continue, right? If you take a look at how much the industry either has been cut or has not been reimbursed, we haven't gotten any increases. There was an analysis done by Bud Langham. Folks may know Bud, was at Inhabit. He looked at the last 10 years worth of final rules. And what was the upside downside? What was the total, the average plus minus for home health, SNF, and long term inpatient rehab, and or LTAC as well? The other sectors of the industry had somewhere between 25, 30 to 40, 40% increases over the last 10 years, which makes sense. Home health, if you include this year's cut, if you assume it's going to happen over the last 10 years, 1%. I mean, my expenses to run my household are a lot more than they were 10 years ago. 1% wouldn't do it. So it really depends on whether or not we've got to get to some understanding with CMS that there is value, because otherwise efficiency only takes you so far. I will finish this answering this question by saying, I do think it could give us a lot of breathing room if it works as well as we think it will. And it will improve the clinician satisfaction, which will have them stay long. So I think I could see this whole halo effect lasting for a pretty good period of time, but it has to be coupled with a recognition that we do deliver value, which goes back to your questions earlier about value-based payment.
Okay, great. There is some hope.
Yes, absolutely.
Great. So at the time of this conversation, we are currently one day before a potential government shutdown with the hospital at home waiver and Medicare telehealth flexibilities at risk. So regardless of the outcome of what we see this week, what does this moment signal about the stability of home-based care, you know, the industry, the policy, what you're seeing there?
Yeah.
Big question for you.
Yeah, that's a big question. I think it probably doesn't necessarily indicate anything different for home-based care than it does for healthcare in general. I mean, what we're seeing I was going to say inability. I actually think it's an unwillingness to work one side with the other. And you can easily point fingers in either direction and be right to some degree. I mean, the whole idea of politics is to air your differences and come to some kind of a compromise. Those days, I don't see them anymore. That's bad for business in general. For where it could hit home health a little bit more acutely is we're making some inroads. With the work over the years, I think a shout out to Steve Landers and the whole team at the Alliance for Care in the Home. We're doing wonderful work. But we've got a ways to go. We're just not seen as a value provider. And so I could just see us being used as a political football of, well, we'll keep this consistently happy by cutting home health. That we've seen that happen before. And so we still have to do this work. If the government is dysfunctional, that actually cuts probably a little bit more deeply into home health. But let's be honest, it cuts deeply into everything. And so I'm hopeful that we can come to some kind of compromise. But at this point in time, as you mentioned, with that looming, I'm not making any predictions about sort of where we're going to be in a couple of weeks or a couple of months.
And speaking of how the government is operating as a whole, we were talking a little bit earlier about how the U.S. healthcare system is operating as a whole. And I'd love to get you to follow up on that, how you see this broader system, the status of it there.
Yeah, thank you. We did talk about that. And I had forgotten to bring it up because it strikes me. So my PhD is in health policy, which doesn't make me smarter than anybody else. The only reason I got it in health policy is because I had done my bachelor's is a PT degree. I got a master's in orthopedics, really in biomechanics. And I was teaching, and that's what I was going to get my PhD in. And then there was a Balanced Budget Act provision in 1997 that went into effect in 99. Half the therapists who graduated that year couldn't find jobs, where the 10 years before there it was money. So it was a real wake-up call for me, for the industry. And so I said, well, if somebody who knows nothing about what I do can make a decision that has a significant impact on my ability to see patients or get a job, like, I got to figure out how to speak to that group. And so hence, that's the path that I've gone down. So I spent a lot of time thinking about it, right? And what I would say more and more is our healthcare system isn't broken. It's not broken. It can't be broken if it doesn't exist. We don't have a healthcare system. We have a collection of silos, some really good silos, Cleveland Clinic, Mayo Clinic, Battle Home Healthcare, right? But for patients, if there's a system, means that there's a methodical way to move through, get what you need from which portion, when you need it, and so forth, that rarely exists. There are places like the Mayo Clinic that actually come close to doing that well, but they are, and probably Cleveland Clinic and some of the other health systems, but they are the exception, not the rule. And so for us, what's been exciting to me in the new role is I'm working with all 8 of our practice lines. And where I'm spending my time is how to build a system within our silos. And I've got great agreement by the board, by the executive committee, by our practice presidents. Like, we want to do that. But it's hard work while you're running the business. But we've been able to do some of those things. A real clear home health to hospice transition program, right? The falls risk assessment for our private pay patients that suggests, you know what, we need Medicare certified home health in a short spurt so they don't go in the hospital. We're reducing admissions, not readmissions. And so I do think there are things that we all can do to help create a system where one doesn't exist. And the final thing I'll say is part of what drives that is what we talked about before, how you get paid, not how much. How you get paid dictates oftentimes how you deliver care. And if you're worried about keeping your margin enough to stay open, you're not thinking about how do I collaborate with an outpatient provider or so forth. And so it takes a little bit of extra energy. That's where I think we have the opportunity to change things. And nobody else is going to do it. So that's why I accepted this role and partnering with lots of other folks to see if we can figure it out.
I'm excited for when we can have this conversation. You've said I figured it out, and looking forward to that.
With Morgan.
So you've been with Bayada now for 17 years, you said. What are the most important industry trends you've seen develop over your tenure with the company?
So,
organization, I should say.
Yeah. So I think there were probably two, and I'll speak to Medicare certified home health. I did help work in the, I worked and led the hospice practice for 3 years. So we could talk about VBID and some of those things. But for home health, I think two maybe they'll pick three things. One, when I first started, we were just getting into this reducing readmissions, hospital readmissions. That was actually a really, in my opinion, a really good place to start getting everybody thinking about. There was an article out of, I think it was New England Journal, that was the landmark article that said a third of patients are back in the hospital within 60 days. I think it was 6 weeks or something. It was like when we didn't do our job. And so that's where a lot of this started. So that focus on hospital readmission, which is still, it's 26%, I believe, of the total 100 scores for your TPS. So recognizing that we all coalesce health systems, skilled nursing, home health around reducing readmissions, I think was a real watershed moment, and one that we need to continue to stay focused on. Two was PDGM, right? That was, which 1999 started in 2000. That really, it required us to think differently about how we deliver care. And there are things about how they structured it that I easily could disagree with. But on the whole, I understand what Medicare was trying to do, and I agree with it conceptually. It required us, the piece that I struggle with, but I understand it, is they removed the extra payments for additional therapy services, right? The PT in me that hurts my heart. But part of the reason is they had pretty clear evidence that it was being abused, which is, you know, sort of shame on us. The reason I point that out not is necessarily because I'm just because I'm a therapist, but I think there's an opportunity for us to look at, has there been a reduction in the functional outcomes for folks? Are we giving them enough of the therapy? And we'll have to figure that out. But PDGM was a landmark change for us in home healthcare. And the final one, which again I think is directionally correct, is home health value based purchasing, because as people know, we're now on the hook for 5% of upside and 5% of your total Medicare revenue as a penalty if you're not cutting the mustard. That can close your shop, and so. I like it because we're all in the same playing field. Now we can argue about, is it the right measure and how do you do this? But Medicare is continuing to change those measures so that there's less and less ability to put your finger on the scale. And I think ultimately, between focusing on keeping people safe at home, reduce readmissions, PDGM with grouping models that make more sense, more payment for wounds, and home health value-based purchasing, which is going to reward the best providers, are things that have moved the industry in the right direction, and CMS should be commended for their efforts in those areas specifically, I think.
Looking to the next 17 years, when you and I are having this conversation 17 years from now, what trend do you think you'll be looking back on and saying, this is what shaped home-based care the most?
I think you've got the folks that are coming into their 60s and 70s, thinking about the world and what they want very differently than the folks who are in their 80s and 90s. Right? They talk about the pig and the python. But the World War II vets had a very different view of what they wanted from healthcare than the Vietnam vets did, for example. So I think what you're going to continue to see is more involvement by patients and families, which I think is a good thing. Right? It will force us to be on our game, to be transparent and so forth. I think it's fundamentally, we have an opportunity to change where care is delivered, and there's going to be more and more pressure on health systems, because right now we are bed capacity. We compete with them for bed capacity, if you think about it that way. There are a lot of folks that really don't need to be in a hospital bed. They could be perfectly positioned in their bed at home. If we can address the workforce issue, which is going to be tricky because as the pig and the python goes through, more need, and the population isn't keeping up with it. So this is where I think we're going to see a huge influx of technology to offset some of the workforce losses. It's going to look very different. And as long as we're thoughtful about making sure that people are at the center of it, the patient and the family, the clinician and the office that's trying to support them, we're going to be fine. If we let the machines decide, we're all going to be in trouble. And I don't think I'm hopeful and somewhat confident we're not going to fall into that trap, because in the end, healthcare is a business about humans taking care of humans. And AI will never be able to substitute for that. Can they augment it? Absolutely. It can actually make us superhuman. And so I'm excited to kind of see what it looks like, but more technology, more expectations for input and access to home-based services. And I'd like to believe, as well, the final piece is more clinicians who are feeling really engaged in taking care of people holistically.
Fantastic. Mike, thanks for responding to my really wide-ranging list of questions.
This was fun.
Any final thoughts or anything that we should talk about before we wrap up here?
I think the questions you asked have been great. I think what I would just leave the audience with is, take heart. When you look at sort of what CMS is proposing, when you look at the big, beautiful bill and what it's proposing for Medicaid, it's easy to get depressed really, really quickly. But the patients that we take care of, and the ones that we are going to be taking care of a year from now or 5 years from now, are like they're depending on us, even if they don't know us at this point in time. And I do think that there are things that we can do in collaboration with payers and so forth, as long as we're thinking about how does everybody win. So share data, those sorts of things. Take heart. There's lots of reason to be down and depressed. There's lots of reasons to be hopeful. And so I'm leaning towards the big H, the big D in depression. It just doesn't, it's too exhausting. So come join me on that side.
Well, thank you so much for ending on that note. And thanks so much for being here today. It's just been a pleasure.
Yeah, my pleasure as well. Thanks for the invite.
One more reminder that if you subscribe to the podcast directly through SoundCloud, a change that we've made recently in our infrastructure could affect your subscription. We apologize for the inconvenience and encourage you to subscribe through a podcast player such as Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Thanks everyone for listening to this episode of Disrupt. For more news and insights into the home health and home care industries, subscribe to our daily or weekly newsletters at homehealthcarenews.com. or consider becoming an HHCM Plus member for exclusive content and opportunities. I'm Morgan Gonzalez with WTWH Media.